Are we supposed to be making a decision of who's going to be the chair at the public safety meeting? Okay.
Considering you're the.
All right. Okay. I guess I'll be ready. Okay. I will be ready.
You on your A game in Detroit?
You know, we'll see. We'll see. We shall see. I did my studying and everything. Okay. And this is a presentation that happened, right? Okay. Hello there. Hello. Okay. Oh, let me check here. Dan. Okay, Kelly.
Friend of ours. Friend of ours is there.
There's so many people. Hello. Hi. Hey, Carrie. Hi. Hello. Hello. Yep, you're right there. I see your name. Oh, my gosh. What? Oh, did they? Oh, yeah. You know what? I didn't even check. Thank you. Yeah, they spelt it wrong last time. They left the L out. Thank you, Sadie, for getting that done. That was one of those things. So funny.
How's everyone doing? Good, good.
Actually, that was total accident.
Yes, I didn't see you going in. Hey, match my shirt.
You know, right?
If it is a school child or if it's a grown-up.
Sorry about that. Just got all my stuff just bleeding into your area here. Isn't that we as what we as women do? What's that? Isn't that what we as women do?
It's like it's just like this large.
Straight out. Yes, in a meeting upstairs.
Oh, I think
it is. Mm-hmm. I think it's community. I think I'm just gonna move this chair over too, just a little bit. Okay, there we go. How was your day?
Good.
I dealt with a lot of teenagers, so you know, yeah. Yeah, I recently did a chapel talk. I was a speaker, and you know, just talking about a lot of this.
Deputy Mayor, we are ready.
Okay. Well, hopefully the other members will be here soon, but it looks like we do have a quorum. So let's bring this City Council workshop for February 6, 2024, to order. Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Start your motors.
All right, thank you. Madam Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
I'd like to note for the record that Mayor McCullough is not in attendance tonight. Deputy Mayor Carter?
Here.
Councilmember Baldwin?
Here.
Councilmember Fullerton? Councilmember Huebler?
Here.
Councilmember McClymans? Councilmember Roach?
Here.
And Councilmember Swatman?
All right, thank you. I think I see reflections. Do we know if the CDC meeting is over and they're coming down, or?
We hear some people. We hear a ruckus.
I'll stand by for just a minute then. Okay. They'll come in.
Hello.
There they are. So we'll let the record show that Councilmember Swatman, Councilmember Fullerton, and Councilmember McClymans are here.
Good evening.
Hello there. Hello.
Oh, sorry.
Good evening.
It was a spirited committee meeting.
I am not unaware of any agenda modifications. So the first thing we go to is a certificate, which I'll read the certificate. This is the City of Bonnie Lake Certificate of Recognition. This certificate is awarded to Friends of Fontana in recognition of the Adopt the Streets program or participants' continuous support of this worthwhile program. Friends of Michael Fontana demonstrate civic pride and concern for the City of Bonnie Lake and their neighborhood, whereby adopting and cleaning 214th Avenue East for 18 years. Mm-hmm. It is this selfless act that stands as a worthy example to all residents of the city. We thank you for your contribution to the beauty and livability of the City of Bonnie Lake. So, thank you for that. All right, so they awarded the certificate. It's been, I believe, signed by the mayor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. May I have a couple moments?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Colleen Littleton, and we are friends of Fontana. This is my husband, James Littleton, Camille Arnold, Kelly Souza, Sarah Keller, Archie and Carolyn Van Valkenburg, Paul Pasalia, and Tammy Carr. And we are friends of Fontana. And first of all, we would just like to thank the city, Deputy Carter, Deputy Mayor Carter, and the council for inviting us and for this wonderful honor. I would just like to share with you guys a little bit about who Mike Fontana was. Our dear friend, March 25th, 2004, Mike Fontana tragically lost his life in a one-car accident in Bonnie Lake. And in 2006, I had seen in the Bonnie Lake Courier-Herald, the newspaper, the printed newspaper, an advertisement for Adopt a Street and asking for submissions, for applications for groups to, you know, take over a street. And so I decided that we were going to take this on. 18 years has gone by pretty fast, but it's gone by pretty well. We do it once a quarter. We have a lot of fun out there. We've only missed one quarter, and that was due to lack of trash. So we did a bunch of bags.
A great problem.
We found some really interesting things. This is just a wonderful honor. This other certificate that we have was given to us in 2012 by Deputy or by Mayor Johnson. Mm-hmm. And so it's really nice that we have this to add to it. And I just want to thank you guys again. Just a little bit about Mike. Mike was from Florida. He loved the Florida Gators. He loved NASCAR. He had a business called the Handyman Can, and he was the type of individual who helped out people. And we clean up the street in memory of the type of individual that he was. I personally despise trash, and when we see it out there, we go get it and we bag it up, and thank you to the Public Works Department who comes and picks it up faithfully for us. Mm. I was friends with Pierce County Sheriff's Department deputy at the time that Mike passed, and he had been serving the department for 16 years, and he told me that in all of the thousands of crash sites that he had seen, that he had never seen an around-the-clock vigil. People were there for days, comforting each other and just, you know, standing there in memory of Mike, and It really impacted a lot of us. And so we're just really happy that we can be a part of the community and to do something positive in his honor. And so, again, thank you guys for this opportunity to speak. And we're just going to keep doing what we're doing in honor of Mike Fontana.
Thank you so much.
I apologize also that our group is probably going to politely excuse our
I hear this.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you.
Don't litter.
Yeah.
Please don't litter.
Okay, well, the next thing on the agenda is a presentation from WCIA, so I'll now hand the floor over to Mr. McEwen for introductions.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. Today we have Rob Roscoe, who is the Deputy Director of Washington City's Insurance Authority. The city's asked WCAA to come out, and as we do whenever we have some new council members, to come and do a little presentation about our insurance and what you hopefully will and will not do as council members.
Thank you. Good evening. Give you a little bit of background. Actually, I think I'm sat there for 10 minutes with the Friends of Fontana. I think I'm now one of them. They've recruited myself and my wife, so I'm sure I'll be out there shortly. This is really kind of a treat for me because I live about 10 minutes from here. So normally I go all throughout the state of Washington. WCA, we insure 170 different municipalities throughout the state or municipal agencies. We don't insure any state or county agency. So you have to be a municipality or serve a municipal function to be a member of WCIA. I've been involved with WCIA now for 24 years. I started as a child prodigy. It's been 24 years. I started there in 2000. I actually left, took a break, and I had the unique experience of working for a member of WCIA. I worked for City of Auburn for 12 and a half years as a director of human resources and risk management down there. So I know what it's like to be a member of a municipality and work for a municipality as well. So I had that unique experience. And I came back to WCIA about 5 years ago, got recruited back to be deputy director. And a little bit of background. We are a interlocal government agency. So we're not an insurance company. We don't underwrite for profit. We're not trying to make money off of our members. We're trying to cover our costs and expenses. Unfortunately, that's been very difficult these last few years. I'll be honest with you, it's a really trying time for government agencies, particularly in the state of Washington, and I'll go over some of those issues during the presentation. And by all means, if you guys have any questions for me, please feel free to fire them out at me. This is why I'm here, to hopefully educate and give you some advice as elected officials regarding your exposures, your liability exposures, as to what the city can face, and as well as individually, as well as you as an elected official. Some of the advantages, like I said, we are not for profit. We try to keep our costs pretty lean. We're run by our members for our members. So every member of WCIA has what we call a delegate. They get to vote annually on our coverage agreement. So this last year we added to our coverage agreement coverage for crisis responders dealing with mental health and individuals dealing with mental health. Previously we had a medical malpractice exclusion that we don't think they ever would have arisen to that level of a claim, but that doesn't mean a plaintiff won't allege it. And if they allege it, that means you wouldn't have coverage with us for it. So we decided to add that in there just to make sure our members weren't going to be exposed to an uncovered potential allegation, because we're encouraging those crisis responders within our members to help diffuse those individuals that are in a mental health state and need additional assistance, rather than just calling the police out for every single call, which, as you guys may be aware of, police seem to get calls for just about every and anything that is a problem out there. So this is a way to hopefully encourage additional resources out there and diffuse those situations. And that was voted on by the full board. So as a member, you guys get to choose what we cover and what we don't cover as well. So that's kind of a unique situation.
So if there's uncovered stuff, is that, where does that go? You know,
uncovered allegations are typically handled by the city and the city attorney, and you can usually do that in-house or you can hire outside counsel for those. Some of the examples of the uncovered allegations, WCIA is created to provide you for your civil claims and liabilities. So anything that's related to torts and civil claims is where WCIA would come in. If it's a takings or if it's a potential fine or penalty like an Open Public Meetings Act or a public record violation, that would be handled in-house by the city itself.
So the city would have to pay for that if, you know, somebody has a $10 million claim against the city for a Public Records Act issue and it's found to be...
Public Record Acts aren't a judgment. It's a fine and a penalty. So they can issue a per-day penalty and per... Yeah, fine. That would be covered by the city. And the thought is, it kind of goes against public policy to indemnify a agency for what they're supposed to be doing anyway, which is disclosing those issues. So we don't get involved in those fines and penalty scenarios that agencies are supposed to be following.
But do we have insurance on top of WCIA then?
No, that's an uninsurable exposure, that you're not going to find a third party able to cover that from an indemnification perspective.
So the city would have to pay it itself out of the general fund or something?
Yep.
Or go out for a loan or something?
And I would pop in to say that none of the insurance pools
no.
cover public records. RMSA used to cover defense, but not the fines, but they have since stopped doing that. So none of the city insurance pools cover public records lawsuits any longer, defense or penalties.
And nor would a insurance company as well, if you just went out to the market, if you could even go out to the market and buy a separate policy, which is really difficult right now to even find. But the other benefit is when there are issues regarding coverage, we have an executive director. Our offices are in Tukwila. We're close. We're local. We're in the state. I worked for insurance companies before. I worked for Safeco. I was one of, I think, 2,500 employees there. We are one of 21. Every city has the direct number to the executive director. And when there are decisions like coverage that need to be made, you can pick up a phone and give her a call. And if there are questions regarding that, or if there are appeals for that, if an issue is denied, you can appeal that to what's called our executive committee. So you can go before the executive committee, which is comprised of members. It's elected by the members to serve. There are 9 members, and they meet monthly to go over claims and litigation issues. So those are just some of the benefits of being in a risk pool, coupled with the fact that we're familiar with what cities do. This is why we were created. We were created back in 1981, primarily because, unfortunately, government agencies are not a very good insurance risk. It's very difficult for them to underwrite for a profit because of the unique exposures that you guys provide. You do a lot of services. You have a lot of different departments. You have police. You have roads. You have streets. You have sidewalks. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people using those services, and sometimes people can get hurt or injured from that and make allegations regarding damages. And it's very difficult for third-party insurance companies or for-profit insurance companies to underwrite reasonably for a profit with that huge exposure out there. So some local municipalities say there has to be a better way to do this. They got tired and frustrated with paying huge premiums without having any kind of control or say-so in how they were being handled and litigated, so they decided to create their own insurance company. And that's when we were created through that interlocal act back in 1981. We started out with 8 Puget Sound cities. We were called Puget Sound Cities Authority back then. And we've since grown. So now we're throughout the state of Washington with over 107 different agencies. We provide the city up to $20 million in liability coverage. That's for your auto liability, your general liability, your employment practices, errors and omissions, public safety, your police officers. What we say in all, one nice, easy to understand coverage document. It's not an insurance policy because we're not an insurance company, but we call it a coverage document that defines the terms and conditions for our members. We also provide property and auto physical damage coverage. In order to be a member of WCA, you have to be in our liability program. The other programs are optional. 99% of our members are in both the property and auto physical damage program as well, because we have very good and competitive, and unfortunately used to be stable rates, but the last few years have been very difficult on us. So those rates, unfortunately, have been creeping up quite a bit to cover our costs. Just to give you an example, we used to have close to $98 million in undesignated reserves 5 years ago. We were down to, I think, $4 million last year. So in 5 years, we've lost close to $96 million. It's been that hard of a market for us. But that's what we're here for, and we're trying to get back to some stabilization. I think we're getting there. The markets are definitely stabilizing from a reinsurance perspective. WCA insures the first $4 million with our own dollars. So anytime there's a liability claim above $4 million, we buy what's called reinsurance above those layers. Just to give you an example how difficult it was, back in 2022, we purchased reinsurance. We belong to what's called Government Entities Mutual. They're a reinsurer of risk pools created by risk pools. So they're not the traditional insurance market. That goes up to $10 million. Then from 10 to 15 million, we buy a policy, and then we buy another policy from 15 to 20 million, because no one carrier wants to be on the hook for too much of any one loss. It's too much of a risk for them. So they try to limit their exposure by reducing their capacity. In 2022, our layer between 15 and 20 million increased 68%, despite never having a claim in that layer. Unfortunately, we had a number of carriers, insurance reinsurers in the state of Washington pull out. They refused to write business in the state anymore because it was so unprofitable and so unpredictable. A lot of states have this unicorn called tort caps. We have no tort caps, which means when there's a claim for damages, it's unlimited. It's whatever the jury defines or deems you responsible for is ultimately what you could be paying. Some states say the most you can pay is up to $2 million. Oregon has tort caps. Washington and California do not. Yes, and we're still here. But that's what we're doing, though. We try to educate our members because we believe the best thing we can do is we know we can't eliminate all risk. It's impossible. You have services you have to provide. What we want to do is educate staff, elected officials, as many people as we can regarding the risks associated with what you do and try and put best practices in place to help prevent, avoid, or mitigate those damages if they do occur. So we spend a lot of money and we provide a lot of trainings throughout the year. We educate a lot. I think last year we did up to 14,000 individuals attended our sessions. We do online and we do in person. That's actually one of the benefits of COVID was we really ramped up our online sessions and we saw a dramatic increase in participation because of that. It's a lot easier to attend when you don't have to leave your office and you can just click online. I still like to get out and do these in person because I feel I get a better interaction and more back and forth with people when I come on in person rather than just do it via Zoom. When you're just doing it Zoom, people tend to zoom out sometimes and they can get distracted and do other things. But I get that, but it still has that benefit and we're happy to do it. Property has been a very difficult market as well. Just to give you an example, before 2017, in 5 years up to from 2012 to 2017, or from 2010 to 2017, there was one disaster that reached $1 billion. From 2017 to 2023, there's been, I think, 12 now, over $1 billion. Global warming, climate change, wildfires, flooding now, you look at what's going on down in California, those all have huge impacts. We buy locally, but we're impacted globally. I have to go every year to Lloyd's of London to purchase insurance for the members, and we have like 18 different carriers on our program because we insure over $20 billion now in property throughout the state of Washington. And that's a lot of risk. And no one carrier can afford $20 billion in losses, so that's where it's spread out amongst multiple carriers. But that's been a real struggle as well. We had a huge loss in 2018. We had a lot of carriers leaving our program, and we were really concerned that our program was going to be in jeopardy. But we've really strengthened it. We've put some controls in place, and we do a lot of appraisals now to make sure we're getting good value on the schedules. So that's just some of the struggles that insurance is a very cyclical market. You see things go up and down, but what's also hurt us is the investments with the bond market. We're a government agency, so any premiums we do collect, we have to invest in bonds. And last year, I believe we had about a $40 million loss, unrealized, because we don't sell, but it still hurt the financials, having a $40 million loss in your financials due to interest rate rising and holding bonds. And when interest rates go up, your bonds go down, unfortunately, market value. So anyway, those are programs we provide for our members. And Bonnie Lake, you guys have been a longtime member of the pool. Yes?
How do we lose money on climate change? Because I would consider that an act of God. So how is that?
Fires. Because of fires, tornadoes, winds, hurricanes, we see a lot more hurricanes. All that gets associated with the geography and the wind patterns, everything that gets impacted with that. So when you have these extreme temperatures, you're more prone, and you have droughts, things get drier, and they're more prone to burn. So when things burn, you have insurance for that fire. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's where that comes into play.
Even so, you would have to cover something that's an act of God versus something that is man-made.
For property. Property losses, we insure your assets. So if City Hall were to be struck by lightning and have a fire, yes, we would pay to rebuild City Hall. Okay. So for elected officials, some of the things that we see. And again, I've been doing this for 24 years. I have, unfortunately, a lot of examples that hopefully we can learn from and move on from. But one of the things we see, first and foremost, is there's some good immunities for you for your legislative activities. But that's when you're acting as a legislative body, as a collective, not individually. Once you start acting individually and you step outside of the council as a whole is where you start creating some potential exposure for the city and for yourself as well. So we always tell our elected officials to try and stick to your role. Look at the adoption of the budgets, the ordinances, and the resolutions, and be a collective body. Once you start acting individually, that's where things can get a little bit sideways, only within the context of the council meeting as a whole and not acting. Once you're doing that as the individual, you lose that immunity. Doesn't mean you're going to be liable. You still have to make a mistake, but you lose any legislative immunity that you might have for that.
So does that mean we should not meet with constituents?
No, you can still meet. Oh, definitely not. No, no, no. You can meet. That's part of your role. But you don't want to put out correspondence from an individual council member with an opinion or acting like what you're speaking for the council, because you can't speak for the council. You're acting as an individual council member. Land use is probably one of our big exposures. Luckily, I believe you guys use a hearing examiner, do you not? Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. seriously, it is one of those things that when you're acting in a quasi-judicial role, you have to act as a judge, and it can be very difficult because of what gets put into the record and when you make your rulings, and there are some appearance of fairness doctrines that you have to follow. One of our biggest losses had to do with Westmark versus the city of Burien. This is when Burien first incorporated. They were, and there's like three different phases of this litigation. It's really, if you want to fall asleep at night, I'll give you a copy of it. But especially land use, you start looking at land use litigation, and yeah, exactly. Everyone's yawning.
I love that.
Okay. But what happened here was you had a development going in play that was vested under King County at the time. This was before they incorporated. Then the city incorporates, and the development was being put up, and they were going through the permit process, getting approvals, and some council members noticed that their views were going to be blocked of the Puget Sound. So they started delaying. They didn't want this development going through, and they kind of, some of the council members ran on a no-growth platform, and they were doing their job to try to kill that development. Unfortunately, they didn't have a legal basis to do so, and their delay caused damages to the tune of over $10 million.
How were they acting individually, though?
No, they were acting as a legislative body.
Oh,
they were doing it as a legislative body in delaying this. So this was very problematic regarding this because they had some vested rights that they were kind of not following through on. And Washington State is very big on that. Now, I will caution you on development agreements. This is something that I do spend a little bit of time on because sometimes those are creative ways to get things done. Development agreements are where you can kind of go a little bit outside your normal code because you're getting something in return for it. We caution our members on this because we've had some recent losses associated with development agreements. There's been a lot of litigation on that, and sometimes it's not even a civil tort, but it falls into contract law because you're breaching a contract with that agreement. So it's determined and adjudicated under contract law, not under civil tort law, which may mean it's even uncovered depending on how the actual allegations are being pled. Coupled with the fact that it can really bind counsel for 20 plus years or so. And even when you think it's expired, there was a recent case, unfortunately, where the city thought it had expired and the developer was now done with his development agreement, where he then litigated saying the only reason it expired and we weren't done was because council delayed the process because they didn't want us to get it done. And the courts believed it. So that's where you think you're done, and you still may not be done. So again, I just caution cities that you may think you're being clever today, but you may pay for it tomorrow, and it can get very expensive, and you're binding potential future councils to conditions that may not want to be met in later years.
Development agreement is kind of a little bit of a weird area, right? Because you would think that normally you have zoning law and stuff like that that the council works within, and then the property owner uses their property rights to, you know, develop under those. But mm-hmm. yet you have this other kind of entity, this development agreement that comes along that all of a sudden things change?
Yep. They change if your code allows for them. And I don't know. Just be careful about that and talk to your city attorney. Use your city attorney wisely and judiciously when it comes to those agreements, and we're here to help as well.
But for a legislative kind of body, a development agreement can be used.
They can be used, but again, what the problem is, it sounds good today, yeah. May not sound good in the future.
What about individuals? Because we've always had that problem where we have, you know, non-development agreements, right? And you have the concept of a future development agreement, but you have, you know, individual council members, legislative members, not mayors and staff, but individual legislative council members go out there and, you know, make a deal with a developer that says, oh, by the way, we can do all this for you. You know, you're going to sign this development mm-hmm. agreement, that individual.
Yeah, and sometimes they're perfectly fine and they work out great. Mm-hmm. I only see the ones that don't. Those are the ones that I had the experience with. Others, some municipalities may love them. When I was down at the city of Auburn, we had a couple development agreements that worked out fine. Mm-hmm. We had some others that didn't always work out so fine. So that's where I just caution council on the utilization of those, just because, again, it sounds good today. You got to think long term and the implications that that has, and the conditions that are in play in those agreements may be counter to future code, but you still have to follow those agreements once they were put in place.
And apparently maybe even longer than their term.
Yes, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
Personnel, this is a big area too. We always caution council members, stay in your legislative role. Let the mayor, city administrator, executive branch deal with personnel issues. There are some recent cases that came down. There's one just in December of 2023. University of Washington, their police department ended up getting hit with a $16 million hostile work environment claim for three officers. $16 million. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money. So there's big dollars that get attached to personnel issues. And sometimes it's not your intent. You're not trying to be offensive. You're not trying to create a hostile work environment. It's how it's being interpreted by others. And if you're talking about protected classes, and unfortunately we've had council members that tend to look at staff as their dating pool. Staff should never be a dating pool for council members. I wish I could make this stuff up. But no, seriously, business professionalism go a long way. And if you're ever told to please refrain or stop certain conduct, try to listen and just stop and don't argue about it, the offensiveness of it. Because again, your intent may not be to be offensive, but it's how it's being perceived by those that are impacted by that behavior. So we have had council members, and here's the difficult part. City employees have the expectation that they're going to work in a hostile-free work environment. if you have, in a non-discriminatory place, if you have staff committing problems and you have policies in place and they go outside of those, there's recourses. There are administrative remedies. They can take disciplinary action. They can take conduct to try to limit and reduce those exposures for staff. Elected officials, you can't fire the mayor. You can't fire council members. You guys are elected. So there's very limited things that staff can do to try to limit that recourse. And they still will try to if there's some exposure being created by that. But unfortunately, from an insurance perspective, it's one of those things that we don't like because it's hard to control. You're elected. They can't fire you. Try and go through the recall process, but as you know, that's not a real easy thing. So, again, it's just one of those things that you want to be careful about that. And if you see it, you're the city of Bonnie Lake. You should report that to the mayor, to the city administrator. Let staff, let the city attorney know so that they can then do a proper investigation. So if someone comes up to you and reports that there's inappropriate conduct or behavior going on, you're basically on notice about that. So you are the city of Bonnie Lake. And even though you're not in that executive branch, you should communicate it to the Human Resources Department, let the city administrator or the city attorney know so they can conduct a proper investigation and make sure that they are creating or doing what's appropriate under the policies.
Have you seen any good examples besides the dating one on that? Because, you know, having a strong mayor form, the mayor takes care of all the personnel issues, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So how would a legislature like ours get sideways with some kind of a labor issue? You know,
not so much a labor. What we've seen is where certain elected officials treat staff in a demeaning, derogatory, or inappropriate manner, either through touching, comments, you look nice today, or you're really looking, you know, it's how things get communicated. It can be very inappropriate in a sexual or aggressive manner, or it could be based on a protected class, race, gender, religion, age over 40, national origin, marital, all these different protected classes that are designed that to protect employees and create that hostile free work environment. So through your communications where you can create that exposure. And from staff perspective, they want to assist electeds with educating you when you have questions. So there can sometimes be interaction. We always say try to limit it through the executive branch, but each city's kind of run a little bit differently. Negligent misrepresentation as well. This can come up. Do not make specific promises or assurances. Don't say, oh my gosh, we're so sorry, this was the city of Bonnie Lake's fault. Don't worry, we'll take care of everything. Again, I wish I could make this up. These are actual statements that have been used against us. Your words will carry weight. Sometimes it may not be your fault, even though you think you're ultimately responsible. This is where we can really get into some sideways situations. We had one situation that had some pretty strict zoning ordinances in their downtown area, and we had a business that had to reside or did some residing on it. So he called the mayor up because mayor ran on a pro-business platform and was very, we're going to get things done kind of guy. Calls Joe up. Joe, I want to reside my business. Is that okay? You bet. Go for it, Bob. No problem. So he takes down his cedar siding, starts putting up stucco. Code enforcement comes out and red tags him because that's in violation of the downtown ordinance. Do we have a problem there? I get a claim for damages from Joe now saying, I have all this stucco, and now my contractor's out of work, and I'm being billed X dollars an hour, but the mayor told me I can do it, and now the city's telling me I can't. Yeah, that's a problem. Because he had detrimental reliance on what the mayor had told him he could do. And now it turns out he couldn't do that, but he relied upon that. So we're going to pay out on those claims 99.9% of the time. So we get that up. We call up the mayor. Mayor, did you tell him that? I did. I might have misspoke, Rob. All right, it happens. Don't worry. We'll take care of it. We'll move along. This is why you have coverage through WCIA. And again, but the lesson learned there is be careful. Your words can carry weight. You don't want to speak off the cuff and give assurances, especially on specific issues. That's what you have staff for. Refer them to staff. Refer them to the planning department. Refer them to code enforcement if it's a code enforcement issue. That's what you can do. And say, don't worry, I'm sorry. Or I'm sorry, I'm not sure about that. Let me get back to you. And you can always follow up after the fact as well. Don't be afraid to say that. But try not to take matters into your own hands, please. Defamation. If the statement opinion is regarding a legislative concern, you're all good. Problem is, sometimes it's not. So be very careful. There is some recent litigation over this as well. I was just reading today, what was it? I think there was a $12 million or $13 million defamation situation. It wasn't in Washington State, but I'll give you one in Washington State, Spokane County. You had a deputy that was fired for allegedly making inappropriate racial comments over the radio. He got fired. He sued the sheriff. He won $20 million. $20 million. But don't worry, it's public money. Well, no, no. What they said was, don't worry, it's covered by insurance. The county's insured not by WCA, but through a county's risk pool. Similar to WCA, they're a government agency as well. So, and that's part of the problem that we deal with is we're viewed as insurance money. We're not insurance money. We're public dollars. We're dealing with public dollars. But these are large verdicts. $20 million for defamation. This wasn't a wrongful death. This wasn't a paraplegic or a quadriplegic injury. This was saying he made comments in a public forum that turned out to be, from a jury's perspective, untrue. And he won $20 million. So there are some big damages that can be awarded. So you want to try to avoid singling out individuals. Now, truth is always a defense. Unfortunately, sometimes that truth can be argued. And a jury has to then interpret whose truth to believe. So just be very careful about that, especially when you're dealing with code enforcement issues and individual names. Calling somebody a slumlord is never appropriate, even though they may have code violations. Stick with code violations. Don't get into the defamatory terms. That's where you're going to get into problems. Public works. Public works, political engineering is what I like to call this. This is one of the huge areas of concern for WCA. Probably besides police, or right there with police, probably our second biggest loss exposure for the pool. Washington State has what's called joint and several liability. Joint and several liability means if you have two or more people at fault and they damage a third party that was fault-free, that fault-free person can collect the entire judgment from any at-fault party, even if you're only 1% at fault. Okay? So if a jury finds you 1% at fault, but the driver 99% at fault, but yeah, maybe the city could have put up a better painting or visibility or done a little bit something extra there to help them out. We're just going to find them 1% at fault, though. But that driver who ran the stop sign and hit the pedestrian in that crosswalk is 99% at fault. That driver only has $25,000 or $50,000 in liability coverage. You have $20 million in liability coverage, and you're dealing with now a fatality or a serious injury that there's not enough insurance to recover. And that's really what drives this, is when there's a lack of insurance from that other at-fault party, they're going to try and find the deep pocket. I'm it. I'm that deep pocket. You kind of need me, though, because you don't want city funds at risk. You kind of need the insurance to come in for that. Hopefully you don't ever need my deep pocket, but that's what we're unfortunately there for, because if you are at least 1% at fault, you could be paying that entire verdict. And we've gotten hit a lot with this. It makes it very difficult for us to try cases because of that exposure. And we sometimes have municipalities saying, look, Rob, we just designed this crosswalk. We took a case, went through the Court of Appeals, City of Puyallup, up at Briley Lake. There was a crosswalk up there. We had a kid, he was, I think, 16 or 17 at the time, skateboarded through the intersection, controlled intersection, driver hit him. Driver was found, I think, like 80% at fault, and we were 20% at fault. But unfortunately, he had some pretty severe injuries. He legally blind in one eye and some other damages. We ended up paying over $8 million on that. That crosswalk was designed, I believe it was like 2010. It wasn't that old. It met METCD standards at the time. It was well-engineered, well-designed. Unfortunately, we took it to trial, and we even had appealable issues, and we took it to trial twice. I shouldn't laugh, but it's job security, I guess, for me. It's just frustrating because there wasn't a lot we felt that the city did wrong, but unfortunately, the jury felt like the city could have done more. Doing more is not a legal standard. It's not a legal standard that we should have to engineer to or design to. Unfortunately, this is one that, because of some decisions that the judge had made at the time, things got in, that we ended up eating and having to pay a jury verdict on. So it's very difficult for us. We really need roads, intersections, streets to be designed by engineers. We don't want political decisions coming into that factor. We don't want council talking about dangerous roads. You may perceive it, think it's dangerous, but you're not traffic engineers. Let traffic engineers deal with the issues surrounding that. You may ask the staff to do traffic studies. That's perfectly okay. But try to refrain from calling things unsafe or dangerous. Because we've had to depose council before and ask them where they got their traffic engineering degree at, and lo and behold, they didn't have one. But we had to go through that process now because the plaintiff is using their words against us in litigation. So be very careful about comments being made, and you may be well-intended, and I get it. We all want safe environment for our community and our residents using our streets, our sidewalks, and our roads. But be careful about opinions being made in open session, because those can and will be blown up and used against us in future litigation. And let traffic engineers put in traffic control devices, speed limits, based upon their engineering principles. They can certainly do a lot of creative things with engineering, but that's where they have to stamp it and they have to approve it. If it's just arbitrary, we want to put in a stop sign here because we get a lot of complaints from the residents, or we want a speed bump, or we want a children at play sign that may not meet certain traffic warrants for it, or it doesn't fit the METCD, Manual for Uniform Traffic Control Devices, criteria to put in that sign at that location, you don't want to arbitrarily put it up. Because if you put it up there, then why did you not put it up here? It eliminates our ability then to defend other actions and decisions that are being made by staff. So be very cognizant about that, because that joint and several liability is such a big exposure for us, especially when you have passengers in vehicles, because passengers are fall free. And road design is a huge concern for all of our members. Like I said, it's probably that and police are our two biggest exposures that we see from a pool with some large verdicts being rendered against us.
I have a question on that.
Sure.
If you have a road that was designed, I'll say 30, 40 years ago, something like that, the city has completely changed, and now you're bringing forth something of, hey, we want to do something about this because we feel it might be dangerous. How do we bring that forward?
That's a great question, actually. Courts are supposed to recognize that you have limited funds and you have discretionary immunity through the budgetary process, how you allocate those funds for improvements within the jurisdictions that you are reside in. So through the budgetary process and through those legislative decisions, you have some discretionary immunity as to where you allocate that. Now, is it going to be pled and used against us? Possibly, yes, but we'll try to defend you saying it was adequately designed at the time when it was put in place. But for the fact that there are new standards, we'll defer to staff and look at what the exposure actually is regarding the circuit or the losses or the loss with that claim in that specific circumstance. Some things we may have to settle because ultimately we can't defend it. Other claims we'll try to defend based upon, again, that discretionary immunity, the limited funds. It was adequately designed based upon the laws at the time and what the engineering criteria was at the time it was put in place. That's a legitimate defense. Whether or not the court and the jury agree with us sometimes is that question of fact that we'll have to make sure we have a good attorney that can argue their case very eloquently and a lot better than I could.
It definitely seems like it's quite the tightrope.
It is.
Being able to talk about something, to bring it forward, to talk about, quite frankly, budgetary issues of, hey, we do want to fund this, and being said, hey, don't talk about it in this way, but at the same time, you know, everything is through the Open Public Meetings Act. You need to do everything in transparency.
Mm-hmm.
So it's two competing interests that make it seem like really difficult to do our job.
Agreed. My one plea, though, would be to try to refrain from putting the descriptors on it with unsafe and dangerous. We recognize that improvements can be done, and improvements not as inflammatory of a term. That's okay. But when you start getting into the opinions of how many people have to die before something gets done, that's not going to help. That's where we're going to see the damages come into play if someone then subsequently is injured at that location.
Thank you.
How many cases go to trial?
It depends. We take quite a few cases to trial when we have good facts and the ability to defend. Unfortunately, in the state of Washington, you have 3 years to file a claim for damages. Plaintiff attorneys are going to wait 3 years to file that claim for damages. And then when you really get to trial, it could be 6-7 years later. And unfortunately, staff change, memories fade, and it's always in their interest then to paint the picture that they want to paint. So when we have good facts, good documentation is always key. No one wants to ever take our word for it. So that's where when we have good documentation that supports the facts and the issues that we feel are defensible, we're not afraid to throw money and go to and defend those cases. Other things are going to be, well, we have a fiduciary responsibility to the whole pool as well, and the risks are such that given these nuclear verdicts that we've seen, state of Washington paid $98.5 million for a wrongful death. Dealing with the tragic loss of the Powell kids from the social and health services. They were killed by their dad, not the social worker. But the social worker took them to dad's court-ordered supervision house. And then dad took them in, locked the door, and murdered them. But they found the state ultimately responsible as well because joint and several liability to the tune of $98 million. That's huge. That exceeds our coverage, and that would then be on to the city to fund anything above $20 million. So that's also a risk that we have, that we don't want our members at risk of going or exceeding your policy limits, because then you have to come up with any remaining money, and that's a risk you take when you go to trial. And so that's where you get into facts specific to those claims, and you have to weigh it. And you really need some good facts when you go to court.
When they go to trial, is that the council get an executive session you'd present?
We do. We give updates in exec session as long as it stays in exec session. And we'll talk about that here shortly.
But you could say, council, I highly recommend you settle, even though this is ridiculous. I pay this money. And then they know we're going to go to trial, and then they lose $20 million.
Ultimately, we have the final authority on any claim settlement authority because it's our dollars and the pool's dollars on that. But we work with our members, and we talk to our members regarding the strategy on litigation in exec session so that they're on board with how we're dealing with this situation. Some things, definitely, we will fight a good fight when we can. We're not afraid to. Other times, maybe, hey, city, here's the risk, here's the exposure. The risk could be, you know, if you're dealing with wrongful death, severe injuries, especially City of Seattle, $60 million for a attorney that got injured by a ambulance in a intersection who was running code. $60 million is a lot of dollars. Again, that's going beyond your coverage. So that's the risk you take when you go to trial, but those are things that we'll have those frank discussions on.
So, and if you're in an executive session and a council member leaks something from that, therefore loses big time, are they held responsible for that?
No. No, but I will tell you this, and this has happened. We go to exec session. I start talking about our strategy on a defense for a claim or litigation, and it gets to the plaintiff what my settlement authority is, and they now know, and we've had this happen. You know what? I'm not going to exec session anymore with counsel. I'm not cluing you guys in. I don't care what you think anymore. If you're going to leak and expose the pool to that kind of a loss, then we're going to cut you out.
Yeah, because once it's in your thing, there's that other scenario where it's kind of like advice kind of scenario where they haven't officially filed a claim or what have you.
We do what's called pre-defense.
You guys are kind of like, you know, going to advise the council. It's kind of a interesting little area where you're like, yeah, go ahead and pay them off. And, you know, even though they haven't really filed a claim with you guys.
Yeah, we have a great program. It's called pre-defense review, where if staff is aware of an emerging issue before a claim is filed and before action is taken place, we will provide legal counsel to review those decisions and implications with what you want to do and give you kind of best scenario as to what you think is going to be able to defend if something is filed.
Sure. Yeah, we appreciate that. But it's a little bit kind of a weird area because in my mind, you guys are usually, you know, yeah, go pay them because we don't want to see them, you know?
Yeah. We don't want to see them. You're right. I can't argue with you there because a lot of times in our experience, we will see them.
Sure.
And we will end up paying. Yeah. And ultimately, you pay or we pay.
Right.
Your dollars are my dollars.
Yeah. So it's
it really, and that's what we tell our members. Again, we pool our money and we're all in this together. But ultimately, this is tax dollars that go towards your assessment. And we've had to increase assessments quite a bit the last few years. Unfortunately, that's been the environment we've been in. I do think we're going to see, hopefully see some stabilization this year. I think we're going to come back to some semblance of normalcy. The last 2 years have been really brutal, and staff can attest to that when they pay their annual assessment. It's been tough.
Is that a per capita kind of charge, or how do you guys do that?
We rate based off of worker hour, and we use an actuary. So an actuary is going to look at your five-year loss history based off of your worker hours and your actuarial group. What happens is WCA is going to find out how much money we need to fund. Then we're going to, so we need 100, let's just hypothetically say we need $100 million for next year. So then we're going to assess our members that $100 million based on the size of the city and their loss history within the actuarial group they fall in.
Nice. So there's like 285 municipal entities or something like that.
170 different. Oh, that are members.
Yeah, that was what I was at, because obviously there's some that you've chose that, yeah, we're not going to insure you anymore, or some that haven't asked.
We don't take any municipality that just wants to join WCA. I get a lot of requests, especially in these hard markets, that they want to join. And we look at their loss history. And they have to have at least average or better loss history for the actual group in which they fall in. Because if I bring them onto the pool and they're a bad risk, that's going to impact you.
Sure.
And I don't want to negatively impact you any worse than you already are by what we have.
So, and conversely, of course, you're bad actors. You could be looking at some municipality and say, hey, we don't want to deal with you anymore.
We don't necessarily kick bad actors out unless they're not following best practices and they disregard and they're going counter to us and creating huge exposures for us. But for the most part, I don't think we have a lot of municipalities that want to pay and are bad. They think they're doing right, and we try to give them good advice, and it's circumstantial. Even then, you may think you've done everything right and we still may have to pay due to the facts specifically surrounding that situation. It's a tough environment. That's why commercial carriers aren't there anymore.
Right. I was going to ask the insurance commissioner in the legislature.
Yep.
Not doing anything to address things.
No, unfortunately, when we speak to we formed a legislative committee for our members because they'll listen to you as a local government agency more than they will listen to us as your risk pool. They view us as insurance, unfortunately, and they look at us as insurance dollars. We're not insurance. We're your dollars. But that's where we think, and we get a better collective voice, and we're creating legislative committees to try and make changes, because it really is unsustainable, the situation that's been going on in our state the last few years with these verdicts and these decisions. City of Seattle just paid $10 million for protesters in January this year up at CHOP. King County paid $12 million for failure to evict a tenant in December. These are all public dollars, $12 million, $10 million. Those are huge verdicts. And that's dollars that if we had to pay out to Bonnie Lake $12 million a year in litigation costs, you know rates are going to go up. We're going to have to collect more and more monies from everybody. So that's where legislatively we need a fix. And we have lobbyists. We're working with AWC and other risk pools as well to collectively try to make changes. But unfortunately, all we hear is they're trying to enact prejudgment interest and other things that are expanding liability. They had a wrongful death statute, I think it was about 4 years ago, that significantly increased the number of people that can sue and created untold rise in our bottom line because of that. And those are real implications. They think it's an unlimited well. Well, there are consequences for these decisions, and unfortunately, you're seeing that through increased assessments. Executive session, I kind of talked about this already. Do not leak it. Do not talk to your spouse, your significant other. When we go to executive session, we really need you to keep that in executive session. And our recourse there from WCI's perspective is we will not inform you anymore on the progress being made regarding those litigation issues if we feel that we can't trust. At the same time, you as a council can self-govern through censure and other means within your own entity.
Can I pop in on this?
Yes, please do.
One of the things that we've seen in the last several years with executive sessions is if you have one member, whether staff or a council member, who is remote to the executive session. We may not know sitting in an executive session that your wife or husband is in the room listening.
Oh, good point.
So it's really important if you're appearing remotely to make sure that you're in a place where no one can overhear you. So just FYI. Thanks.
No, thank you. That's a great point. And I know sometimes you may think, oh, I'm just going to talk to my – don't talk to your wife or significant other or anybody else, husband, girlfriend, boyfriend, what, best friend, just – refrain from discussing city business from executive session to anybody. Written communication as well. And again, we don't deal with Open Public Meetings Act or public records, but that is something you have to be cognizant and aware of because it does create that exposure to fines and penalties. Emails are public. You are an elected official. Everything you do is a potential public record. Do not conduct city business on your personal computers or your personal cell phones unless you're willing to give that personal computer, your cell phone, over to the public records officer so that they can collect that metadata and disclose all that information if they ever receive a request, because it is subject to disclosure. So you don't want to create that issue. I have two cell phones for a reason. I am a public employee. I have a work phone and I have a personal phone. I keep my personal phone personal and my work phone for work. You don't want to cross those lines because, again, it's a fishbowl. And we are encouraged to be open, and that has its benefits for the public. We want to be transparent in what we do. We're not governing in behind closed doors in secrecy, but at the same time, it creates a potential fine and penalty issue for you if you fail to disclose those documents. Coupled with the fact that you're a legislative body, you have Open Public Meeting Act requirements. We don't cover Open Public Meeting Act issues, but we would ask your city attorney if there are concerns about that, especially with forwarding emails and CCing all on that, you could be creating a open public meeting violation with that chain of emails and getting a consensus. You don't govern before meetings. You do it in open session. You don't want to do straw polls and then forward that on to everybody. How are you going to vote on this? No, that's not appropriate. That could be a violation. So be very careful about that. Social media is also a concern. Be careful about creating a public forum. And then once you create that public forum, if you're doing so and you're conducting city business on a social media account, now you're limited. You cannot now start blocking the hate groups and everybody else that now is chiming in on your public forum, because that could be a potential First Amendment violation. So be very careful about that. Try and keep social media separate. You can have a personal account, but don't conduct city business on your personal account. Be very careful about that.
And I'll just add for social media, and I'm happy if anyone wants to talk to me offline about social media issues that you may have, I'm happy to give you advice. But one of the other things I've seen happen is a council member posts a news article about something that's happening in the city, and then three other council members make comments on, you know, the first council member says, "Oh, I look forward to supporting this." Three more council members add comments to that Facebook post saying, "Oh, me too, me too, me too," and then you just have a serial meeting. So you have to be careful. You can sometimes it can be a public records issue where you have to then save it and disclose it if it's responsible to a public records request. But it also can be an open public meetings issue, and no one intended to do it. They may not have even seen the other council members commenting, but I've seen that happen.
Yeah, thank you. It is very concerning.
So, question on that then, just to kind of make sure, if a council member does put something on their personal social media and that something like that happens and, you know, it's not an intention, what do we do? Like, what should we do?
Call me. Call me. Save it. We should make sure, you know, and we'll talk about it. The law is changing. The case law is changing on whether a social media post is considered a public forum or not. When President Trump was in office, his Twitter feed was considered to be a public forum. There's been cases that said other elected officials' Facebook or Twitter feeds were not. It really depends on how they're used. So I'm happy to talk with you more about it if you want to discuss it. It's nuanced and it's evolving.
And then what if you have, say, as a council member, we set up a social media account that's just for city things and like informing the public of like what's going on, can you turn off commenting? Would that make it?
It depends on what it is, but yes. If a council member wanted, I haven't talked to staff about this or administration, but generally the general approach is if a council member wants a public official council member page, it should be managed by the city or at least kept where the city can archive it, because it would be a public record. So I know that some of the bigger cities and counties do that. You certainly can have a personal page, and you can have a campaign page. That's not necessarily, but if you're using your campaign page when you're in office to solicit feedback, to help form policy decisions, then you could be getting close to or over the line where it could be considered a public forum.
I think I'll add too that when we, you know, we've done some of the trainings there at the AWC conference. One of the things that they had talked about is if for some reason, you know, you have a political page, let's say, and then you were to place some sort of a post with the city and even one person commented and then you shut off comments, you're in a deep water situation. It either has to be completely off or completely open.
Okay.
Yeah.
As I've seen, you know, different social media where there's a video of, I don't even know who it was, but I remember seeing something where somebody made comments after some legislative session in the state government or something, and it was like, here's everything that just happened in this,
I don't remember if there was comments or not, just kind of like for us, how does all that play?
You can certainly not have comments on things, but you want to be really careful if you're using something in an official capacity. Versus a personal capacity.
It's even more ironic or funny. Sometimes the state or the courts exempt themselves from those same conditions. Yeah, so do as I do, or do as I say, not as I do scenario.
Representative Roach over there knows all of
them. I think that is it. Any other questions for me while I'm here? Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly appreciate your time. I know being an elected official can be thankless, and I know how much time and dedication it does go into it. So thank you. I do appreciate you serving. And like I said, I am local, so I do definitely benefit. I'm a Bonnie Lake utility user, so thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you for inviting me out here. I really do appreciate it.
Are you related to Roscoe's in some way?
My sister-in-law. She's the mayor.
Open council discussion. I have something, so I'll start, and then we'll get around. But I guess there's a couple things. Number one, I'm going to give you the AWC conference dates, June 18th to the 21st. And that's in Vancouver, Washington this year. So just be aware of that. I highly recommend everybody to go, but if you can, there is an opportunity to learn a lot, and there's an opportunity to network, and that sometimes is worth it just for that. So,
is there reimbursement for that? Is there any? Yes.
I'm sorry.
Reimbursement for fees and that kind of thing.
Travel hotel.
Yeah, the city is typically taking care of our fees for that.
Meals
and the hotel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Mileage.
Mileage. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The next issue I have is I want to just make everybody aware of some stuff that's been going on in the last probably month and a half or so. The food bank has been looking for property for 6 months to a year, somewhere in there. Former council member Evans was appointed to the food bank board on December 19th. He, along with their legislative person, told the food bank about the Reed property, and some mid-January sometime, they ended up out there looking at the property. My understanding is they had permission to be out there. It was about a week after that, when directly asked, that Evans told the food bank people that there was actually somebody else interested in that property, being MRAC, and that there was a current MOU, but it was essentially kind of dead on arrival. Then on January 25th, I've had to make some notes to remember all these times and dates or whatnot. While I was in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago, Chris Lear called me in regards to conversations with the food bank, Tarragon, MRAC, and then being interested potentially in the Reed property. And then on the 29th, which was last Tuesday, Justin called me and kind of apologized for not letting me know if this was all going on or whatnot. And then on the 30th, which was Wednesday, 29th was Monday, the 30th was Tuesday, Chris Lear invited several people to a meeting in regards to kind of a lot of things going on with the food bank, MRAC, and Tarragon, and the city. I was there with Jason Sullivan, and again, Tarragon was there, people from MRAC were there, people from the food bank were there, trying to find some solutions to this whole thing. no deals were made or anything. There was a lot of brainstorming going on. You know, what can we do so that we can hopefully come out with a win for everybody? I thought it was a good meeting. It was a positive meeting. And it seemed like there's some definite give and take that could come from everybody. With that, it appears that information about the appraisal may have gone out at some point. It sounds like Councilmember Evans probably told somebody. I can't say if that's for sure or not, but that's what I'm led to believe at this point. So that money issue might be out there. All that to say, I was really upset that this was going on. I felt like it was kind of going on behind our back a little bit. I appreciate Justin calling and apologizing for that issue. We have, I think, tried to move forward. I think there are some possibilities. There may be some meetings in the future. That meeting was Chris Lear's meeting. I want to make sure that, you know, we are trying to be as transparent as possible and there's not secret meetings going on. And that's why I kind of wanted to let all of you know what is going on. I talked to you a couple of you in the last couple of days, but because of the Open Meeting Act, I waited till now to kind of tell everybody about this because it needs to be done all together. So I just wanted to make sure that that information was out there. And if anybody had any questions, I can try and answer those for you.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes.
A couple questions. Actually, we just heard from MRAC last week that they were not able to, they were working on getting the insurance coverage for the $2 million just for them to be able to get an appraiser to come on and help them figure out what they're going to do with that property. So my question is how did the food bank and Justin Evans get on the property? And is MRAC going to be held accountable if there's something that happened on that property? Well, because they have the MOU with us. So when we have somebody under an MOU, why would we allow somebody else on the property when we already have a good faith agreement with somebody who's trying to work towards something? And that seems a little bit secretive that they got onto the property when we have an MOU for that property. So how did that happen?
So I was called by Stacy and she asked if she could walk the property with board members. I told her yes. We have an MOU, but we do not have an access agreement with MRAC. So it
So, like MRAC can't get somebody to come on to the property without a $2 million insurance agreement, you know, that they have coverage so that they can have somebody come on to the property to assess the property, figure out what they're going to do with that property, and then we just allow people to come onto the property when it's under an MOU.
So MRAC, what the access and use agreement would allow them to do is go on the property, do excavation, actually develop a site plan, as you said, do surveys, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Food bank was just walking on the property. Much in the same, again, as MRAC has taken any number of, if not all of you, out on the property and walked the property.
So can we have an assessment group call you and have you walk the property with them?
Once they sign the access agreement. MRAC has not signed the access and use agreement that they've had since September 27th.
I think what I'm kind of gathering is I have the same exact questions on this.
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard about this and I saw the pictures on social media, I went, what the heck? Yeah. Why is somebody else being given permission to go on there without city personnel same exact scenarios of what if they fell? What if they got hurt on the property? You have a former council member, a former mayor, and food bank on a property. They don't have any liability insurance, but MRAC, what my understanding is any time that they've been out on the property has been with council members or city staff.
Council members, but not city staff.
Okay, but the food bank was given permission to go on without council members or city staff.
Yes, I allowed them to do that. It's
and I will say, to be fair on all sides, MRAC went out on the property with a lot of us to kind of show us around and see what kind of thing they would do too. So I want to be careful about getting too hung up on that. There is an issue. It is an issue because I feel like we have an MOU and we should be moving forward, but it's not something that is completely out of the ordinary, I would say. And then I would also say that I think Stacy's reached out to all of you. I would encourage you to meet with her and see what she has to say. I would also encourage you to meet with Doug Clevenger and Scott Nall about what they want to do. And so I just want to be fully transparent. The other thing is, I'll throw out there, my wife sits on the board of the food bank, and should anything come to a vote or anything like that, I would probably have to recuse myself from that because there's a lot of conflicts of interest or whatnot. So I just want to get the information out there. I think I'll let you talk to Stacy in the future so you can figure out exactly what the reasons are that it would make sense for them, because I can't provide those in a way that is all encompassing that she can. So anyway,
Angela.
Yeah, this is a bit unfortunate as far as just how I guess it all went down. I could understand why you would be upset, Deputy Mayor Carter, and I think it is very gracious of you to then call on meetings, to then talk to all parties that are involved. I know that it was said that there was an agreement that was not signed by MRAC as far as not being able to be on the property. Okay, access agreement. And so I guess then did the food bank sign an access agreement?
No.
Because you're saying MRAC did not.
So the difference, again, is the access and use agreement allows MRAC to go out there with contractors and work to developing a property. The food bank walked the property much in the same as all of you have had with MRAC. They've just walked the property.
And so I guess
And so we've allowed MRAC to walk the property without the access and use agreement. So they've not been treated any differently.
Okay. So then I guess, is there some sort of a plan then that we're unaware of that the food bank is going to be a part of the Reed property? Is that why they're walking the property? Is there more information that we're not privy to, I guess?
I would say my last understanding is that they're interested in the property. Whatever that means.
I mean, I think we're all a little dumbfounded.
Yeah.
So.
As was I.
Yeah.
I think I saw a hand, Councilmember McClyman's.
Yeah, so the property is still surplus. Is that the
property is still surplus. So the resolution still authorizes the mayor and myself to accept offers for purchase and bring them forward to council.
Okay.
How do we get it off the surplus? How do we get this access and use agreement done? I know we had talked about at our last council meeting being able to, as a council, talk about the insurance policy and getting stuff moving forward. I think I heard that MRAC was able to get an insurance policy.
1 million, though. They need 2
million. And it is on your council workshop agenda for the 20th to talk about liability issues.
Is it on the agenda to talk about liability issues, or is it also, it's kind of like when the guy just came here and sat here, right? He's here, I'm helping to educate us, which is great. Is that what that next council meeting is for, or is it to also find solutions to be able to move forward with MRAC?
It's on the retreat.
Okay, which is past the 20th, correct? In March.
So the 20th, when we were talking about the access and use agreement, when the MRAC was last year and the insurance issues that they were running up against, we talked about putting it on an upcoming council workshop agenda to talk about risk and liability and how much risk and liability the council was willing to take on. Mm-hmm. And again, we're kind of, you know, mixing apples and oranges in here. This just isn't people walking the property. MRAC wants to get on the property, have contractors out there. Presumably they're going to do soil bores. They're going to be doing surveying, any number of things that would create a liability for the city. The property is currently posted as no trespassing. We have a known squatter that's been out there that hasn't signed an access and use agreement. I know the neighborhood HOA out there has used the property in the past for an Easter egg hunt. I think we would all be a bit remiss if we don't understand that people are walking on that property without city permission.
So you mentioned that they haven't signed the access and use agreements, and it's been sitting there since September.
It's been in their hands since September 27th.
But as Doug Clevenger presented to us two weeks ago, was that the problem has been the insurance.
Yes, correct.
So I just want to make sure that we're clarifying. It's not that they're not wanting to sign the access and use agreement. It's they're trying to get the insurance.
Yes, they have not been able to get insurance that meets the requirements as outlined in the access and use agreement. And it's the same access and use agreement that we entered into with Chris Lear when he used our property out on 224th with the same insurance thresholds.
But did they purchase that property?
No.
Chris Lear did.
No, we retained three and a half acres for the stormwater decant facility off of 96. Then that's how he was accessing the property when he began his construction activities out there. And we still own that property.
Gary,
so I guess I apologize. Back to Councilmember Huebler, I don't know if I answered your question. If you wanted to take it off I don't know how you would take it off of the surplus list and still entertain an offer from
them. You wouldn't. It was deemed not needed for the city. If the city decided they had a need for it, you want to open a well there, it's owned by the water utility. If you had a need that came up, we could certainly pass a resolution saying it was, you know, amending the old resolution, it's no longer surplus, but then you couldn't sell it. So you can't sell it or lease it for other use unless it is surplus, and you can't lease it for use. You can't lease it for use certainly at less than fair market value unless and until you bought it from yourselves, because it's owned by water utility. And when a enterprise fund, which is a utility, owns property, it's been paid for by the ratepayers. And so the ratepayers have to get paid back. So if you wanted to, for example, lease it for a use other than, you know, that wouldn't serve the water utility, and for less than fair market value, you would first need to take general fund dollars and transfer them to the water utility to buy it from yourselves, and then you would hold it as general fund property, and then you could lease it for, if it's less than fair market value, you'd have to have other public interests met by that lease, because you cannot have a gift of public funds, if that makes sense. But if you have a use for it in the water utility, then you could amend the resolution that surplused it. But you can't do anything with it other than use it for water utility if it is no longer surplus to the city's needs. My understanding is the potential well that's out there is not in use. It doesn't have any current use to the water utility, which is why it was surplused some years ago now, at least five, certainly before I was city attorney.
I actually asked that it be added to the surplus list several years ago because I knew it was just sitting out there. My question would be, let's follow the logic, the line to logical conclusion type deal. Let's say we said we want to purchase it with the general fund dollars. Does it need to be surplused in order for the city to do that, or no?
Well, it's already surplused.
It is now.
It's already surplused, so you wouldn't have to do something else.
From the surplus. So my question would be, if we removed it from the surplus list, could the city still buy it from the general funds from, you know, or using general fund dollars to pay back the water utility or no?
Well, it wouldn't be surplus from the utility. So it would, I think you'd still have to keep it surplus and then you could buy it from the general fund with the general fund money from the utility, from the water utility. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you.
It's a little bit convoluted, but, you know, it's the way
just,
it works.
Just clarifying on that, so like what you're saying is we would keep it on the surplus list, and then if we wanted to enter into a lease agreement, a long-term lease agreement with MRAC, we would have it on the surplus list. The general fund would then purchase it from the water utility fund.
Correct.
To then that would be pulled into the general fund, and it would no longer be on the surplus list, but it would be in the general fund's ownership.
It would basically be, yes, yes, okay. I think so.
The city would own it so that we could lease it or...
You could lease it. If you wanted to sell it, there's no need to transfer it to the general fund. It's just that the sales proceeds would go to the utility fund because that's what where the funds came to purchase it in the first place.
Councilmember McClymonts, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out there's a distinct difference between, what's his name, who's building?
Chris Lear.
Chris Lear's organization as a contractor, a licensed contractor, I assume, in Washington State to do all that work, and a recreational organization, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that is essentially the hiccup in the ability to get insurance, right? Mm-hmm.
That's my understanding, yes. That's the big hiccup.
Apparently. But again, on the 20th, maybe we can delve into the details because, you know, wouldn't they be hiring a contractor? They're not going to be doing that work. They would
correct.
Be hiring
correct.
A contractor, which you would think would meet those requirements.
Have the insurance.
Correct.
It's just this interim phase of them working through. But that's a topic for the 20th.
Yes. All right. I can't see anybody, so I don't know. If
Council Member Roach raised his hand.
Thanks. So my thoughts on this, I think that the meeting that you had with Chris Lear when he pulled some of the stakeholders together, I hope that continues. I think that's where the solution lies, and I think it can be a win-win for everyone. But I think one of the big rubs here is that the council's been totally taken off guard and had no prior notice, and we have an MOU already in the works. I don't think that was Stacy from the food bank's desire at all. I know Stacy, I don't think she would do that. I think she got some bad advice, and now she's trying to do some damage control there. But I think that there is, you know, potential for Stacy or food bank and MRAC to be able to work things out. I think it's going to take some time as they go through things. I just want to put on record, one thing I would hate to see is someone to rush into things and end up blowing this thing up and make it a huge mess. So for anyone who's listening out there, I think at this point it is to bring the stakeholders together, get in a room and figure some things out where we can find a win-win. And I think there is, again, a way forward, but we don't want to rush anything at this point. We're just going to disrupt things.
Yeah.
I completely agree. And I've reached out to Council Member Morrell. Mm-hmm. Pierce County was the big blank spot in that room. And so I'd like to get Pierce County involved as well, because I think there's another stakeholder there that we can get involved.
Yeah, good. Good work there, Deputy Mayor. I appreciate your getting those people together to talk, because as you pointed out, there are several interest groups there. You know, they seem to collide at times, but, you know, getting them to talk is great work to get, you know, everybody to consider all the options. As Mr. Roach, Councilmember, points out there, that there's probably multiple things we're not thinking about. But, you know, it happens in the background. All that stuff does, a lot of offline stuff. It can't happen in these great big meetings. So, you know, some of it works out, some of it doesn't. Some of it falls aside, some of it comes forward. So, yeah, I like it.
Yeah, appreciate that. And I just, in full disclosure, it was Lear's meeting. He called it. And so I appreciate him doing that and getting mm-hmm. those people in the room. and I think it will continue. Everybody did seem like they want everybody to win. Everybody likes everybody and wants to see all of those organizations, you know, come out with a win and a home.
Definitely.
Okay.
Deputy Mayor Carter, I have a question. I'm just wondering, I will be having a meeting, with Stacy, but I was wondering, is there a way for us to be able to reach out to Doug Clevenger and Scott Knoll? I don't have any of their contact information, and then try to kind of figure out what their thoughts are.
Yeah, I'll send out their information. I think Doug is going to be out of the country, I think, until the 22nd. But I believe Scott would be happy to talk to anybody, and Doug will as soon as he gets back as well.
And my understanding is Scott Knoll was at that meeting.
He was. Yes, Scott Knoll, Doug Clevenger, both at that meeting.
Yes, but I wasn't. So right. Deputy Mayor Carter advised us to contact Stacy as well as Scott and Doug and try to figure out, you know, what their thoughts are. I'm not going to try to negotiate anything, but I want to know what their thoughts are, what they're thinking, and what their ideas are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to find out what are their needs for both places, and what are their ideas? How can we get through this thing?
Yeah.
So, okay. So I'll send that out after this meeting. Thank you.
I'll ask, and I know we probably can't move it, but of course I have a significant conflict date with that, the council
retreat.
Yeah, so you know I'm gonna have to be remote or something, or I don't know if it's possible to scooch it a day or so. But
well, we have already three people. Two, it looks like, or
it's three.
Council member McClyman's also. So we have three. Would you be remote?
I would. I would move my thing, but really, there's a big thing going on. I feel really bad about it. You know, I just can't move. There's just no way. But I could like pop in remotely, possibly, kind of on the side. But, you know.
I gave up a cruise for this meeting.
If we could push it a week out, you know, I don't know what everybody's, because I think we planned that before, like Councilmember Roach and Councilmember Hubler was on board.
Yeah, we put the date out here and started moving forward with it and planning. And I know that the city's put a lot of work into getting it ready. I don't know how easy or difficult it would be to move it. But if we have several council members that can't be there, is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, it sounds like three or something like that. But if we, you know, because I don't know what availability would, is it like, are we gone for, I have a conflict with that date. You know, it's like scooch it 2 days down. I don't know what other members have conflicts or are looking at, if they're gone for a month or not.
I mean, is there a way to push it? It's three people that are going to be gone, so. Is that not a possibility?
I can look at the schedule with Deputy Carter and put out some dates and see what would work. If you guys can send me your availability for the next couple of weekends after that.
Yeah.
That would be appreciated.
Okay. So we want to definitely do it on a Saturday?
Either that or we could do it during the day, during the week.
I'd take a vacation day.
I suggested that too.
You know, necessary.
Well, everybody send your availability and we'll see what works for everybody. All these
in
things
the,
are
in the next 2 weeks after March 2nd, right?
We have a lot of different schedules.
They do. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
I have a question. So it was, I think you said, Deputy Mayor, that Tarragon was in that meeting as well. Does that mean the Tarragon issues are rescinded, not going anymore? What's like?
Well, they'll the lawsuit is done, and so I think having a discussion with them and seeing where they can give a little bit and where we can give a little bit or whatnot is appropriate. Because at some point, you know, they're going to want to do something, and we're going to want to see something that's positive out there. So I think there's a they seem like there was an opportunity to talk about that stuff and figure it out. And it's not going to be immediate. It's going to take a while because they have to have a project that's going to pencil out for them. And we want a project that's not going to destroy the city of Bonnie Lake.
Okay, that's awesome to know. That is now open for discussion again. And then one more question. There was, in the November CDC meeting, as I was going back and watching that, there was a discussion about a large chunk of property that could be developed at some time. I swear they said like 400 and some acres.
Oh, yeah. Plateau 465.
Where is that?
Just like right over there.
East of down on 192nd on your way to Tahale, out in unincorporated Pierce.
On the left.
So it's several miles out of the city limits.
Yeah.
But it's, why would it be developed as a city?
So Tarragon owns it, and they were planning to do, what?
They're planning to build a sewer. Or some kind of development.
It's within our sewer service area.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not city property. It wouldn't end up being a huge expansion to the city unless it was annexed in.
Correct. Right.
Okay.
And it can't be currently annexed because it's not.
And it's not city-owned property either. It's privately held.
Okay.
And
you're saying it can't be annexed in?
Not currently because it's not contiguous or whatever.
Yeah, it doesn't touch.
Jason's your expert on those issues.
So, yeah. So, In the county, you have urban growth area, which includes everything in the county that's urban. So the city of Bonnie Lake is technically part of the urban growth area. Mm-hmm. And then you have kind of a subset of that is, and Councilmember Roach and I just went through a big meeting on this, what they call potential annexation areas, which are areas of the urban growth area that have been identified by a specific city to annex those areas. So for us, that's the area kind of between South Prairie and 112th. That area has been identified as a potential annexation area with the city of Bonnie Lake, and we can kind of annex it whenever we want.
Where Rhododendron Park is?
Yeah. I think it's right before Rhododendron Park.
Yeah.
It's Ponderosa. Rhododendron Park is south of 112.
Okay, got it.
So I guess if you were going down the new road,
the
198th, when you get to that new signal, it's at 198th and Roads Lake Road.
Yeah.
If you were to, 112th is what would extend right there.
Okay.
It's kind of undeveloped. That's kind of the southern limit of our potential annexation area. Everything between 112th and Tahale is also, and I think 214th, kind of that box, and 198th is urban growth area, but it's not affiliated with any city or town. So the city could make an application to the county to have that affiliated with the city and go through the process to annex it. That would require a vote in that whole process to go forward. It's not been on our long-range plans to work that way. It was at one time the council's desire to annex kind of all the way through Tahale. That's changed over the years. And Tahale's actually been identified as a potential incorporation, so they would incorporate in kind of their own city or town. But it is our sewer service area, so regardless of whether we annex it or it stays unincorporated rural, unincorporated urban Pierce County, we are still the sewer provider, just like we are the water purveyor for most of the area around the lake, which is both rural and urban. I hope that answers kind of the three different buckets.
So that leads me to a whole nother question. I know I'm full of them tonight. As a sewer provider for that large of an area, what is that going to do for the sewer system down in Sumner that we have this ILA on?
Yeah.
So is that going to put us over capacity?
I believe when we did the capacity bump back in the day, we accounted for some of that growth. So,
okay.
I'd have to dig into it, but I want to say that there was a reason that we overbuilt the lift station and got the additional capacity above what we're using is because we knew that there were projects out there like Plateau 465 that would come online and we would need that capacity. So we have excess, my understanding, and being Dave, you know, 2 weeks in, my understanding is that we have excess capacity at the plant, and part of that was based on kind of these needs with the Holly, but we are with Plateau 465 and the rest of our sewer service areas. So, but how that gets served, what it looks like, that's all yet to be
future planning
effort. We haven't even had those conversations with Tarragon.
Where could we find a map?
That's something I had asked Ryan about before, and he had told me that they had we had the excess capacity there in order to do those.
And, okay. And certainly, yes, we can send you a map. And also, there's no infrastructure in the ground out there.
I'm just wondering where could we find a map that tells us like
we can
where
send you one.
City website.
The plant, like where future growth could be, where all are the annexation possibilities for future growth. Are those all on our website?
They are.
Yeah, and if you look in the comp plan, there's actually the old annexation proposal in the comp plan in the community development element, and it shows kind of the old, we'll annex everything to include Tahale map, and so you can see kind of what is all urban growth between us and Tahale, and it kind of breaks it down. We've kind of broken it apart a little bit over time, and we'll be bringing an updated map as we bring those elements forward. And I can also email you.
Okay. I love it.
Getting the sewer from that area to the plant is the big trick.
Yes. My neighborhood was, I actually petitioned the city and the county to become annexed into the city years ago because we were county and we were touching city
island,
limits.
Right, yeah.
And that was, so I know there's other areas that want to be brought into the city limits. There's a lot of great reasons to be brought into the city limits. So I will go looking for those maps. I love that.
And I'll email them to you as well. So
thank you. And Jason, I just want to say you're doing a great job for only being a couple weeks in. You've had a lot of learning to do.
All right. Any further discussion?
Yep.
I think I see a hand. Is it Councilmember McClyman's?
Are you asking for a new open discussion, or are you asking for continued discussion?
That's a good question. Are we done with this one?
I am. Thank you.
Okay. I think we're done with this one. So, yes, if you want, yeah, any other open discussion?
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been attending the Sumner Bunny Lake Capital Facilities Committee meetings. The last meeting will be next month. They will put together a recommendation for the board. It looks like they're going to put forward a recommendation somewhere about $500 million for Sumner High School, middle school in Tahale, and then some odds and ends. It's basically, that's going to suck most of the money out of the budget because those are big projects. They're desperately needed for many different reasons. So not, I don't think the school district has a lot of choices with the money that they can bond versus their need to serve the students. So I say all that to make this point. The prediction is, so the pool facility will not make the bond effort because it's at the very last item on the Sumner High School list. That list is so long that there's just not enough money. We were talking about potentially $1 billion in bonding total, and that was probably somewhere around that. That's where they would put the pool in, right? As they get close to that $900 million mark, the numbers are kind of staggering. Really, you know, when I think of Bunny Lake as a small town, but you think of those numbers and it's crazy. But anyway, so the pool's probably going to not make the bond, which means in a couple of years it's going to close. There's a potential for it to make the bond if they had a place to put the pool. That's their biggest problem. They don't have anywhere to put a pool. I was wondering if the council would entertain setting aside some property in the city somewhere that we own to put the pool, the aquatic center on. The school district's willing to bus, it sounded like, the kids between places. They understand that they have to take care of those logistics. Getting the free land is their problem. Go ahead, Jason.
We kind of had figured this might come up as an issue, and if you remember when we did the Midtown Park plan, there is a big square that is the same square footage that is proposed to be the Sumner High School pool.
That's like years.
No, the footprint for the building, so we can give them that footprint at any time.
Okay.
I have a question about that. Is that in the White River School District?
No.
214th and South Prairie, there's a small area. It's in White River.
So we're positive about that, because that was the discussion last night was, oh, that's White River, we can't do that. So for sure it's not White River, that's good news. I will take that back. As we talked about that, they were excited until somebody pointed out that that was White River School.
There is.
Close.
It's on the residential side, and it's on. Yeah, I will double check and confirm that.
How much property do you need for a pool and parking?
The way it was set up was there was. I got the Ryan mic.
Ryan mic.
It was set up that it could be developed with enough parking to serve both a future community center for the city and for a second building that had the same square footage as a pool facility would need. So it could be used if the school district wanted it. It was designed to accommodate both. It would just be kind of that phasing of when those things would get done. But the site plan was designed with that specific issue in mind. We just couldn't say it was the school district's because it's, you know, they weren't ready to commit. No one's ready to commit, but we did envision the possibility.
I remember seeing that on the plan.
Pool and the parking and maintenance operation going?
That's what they would bond.
So they would bond the pool building and the maintenance operations?
Correct. Well, they can't bond maintenance and operations, right? Okay.
But that could be levied? Or is that just part of
that? I think that's already in their current budget. And yes, it's probably levied.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with that. What they can bond is the construction of the pool and the facilities. And I believe it includes parking, which is the hitch and the giddy up for the high school, right? Because that's the very last step is redoing all that. For the parking, they got to get everything done, and then they can put the pool in. Down at Sumner, and so there is also in the bond there will be very little for Bonnie Lake proper in terms of schools. Granted, Lake Ridge has been remodeled, Emerald Hills has been remodeled, but those are relatively minor remodels compared to $200 million. For a brand new massive middle school in Tahale, which is needed, mm-hmm. and completing $200 million to complete Sumner High School.
Yeah, I've had some discussions with Mr. Clark about everything that's needed and the possibility of, and is it still the possibility of, if the new middle school is built, that would be like a super middle school, and Mountain View could be turned into an extension of Bonnie Lake High School? Or would that not?
So there is that's what we're trying to work our way through. We didn't quite get through that whole thing last night. Basically, that's the idea. There are logistic issues with moving students between schools, right? Because they aren't adjacent. They're close, but not really adjacent. So but that's the basic idea.
We found the hitch in the giddy up. It is in White River. The binding line is just south of the park.
Okay.
Winter.
Not to say that we can't start working on other solutions and get creative.
I don't know why we haven't done that anyways, just because
There may be some bonding issue money-wise.
Yeah, it could be that you're building a facility outside of your school district boundaries. I don't know, but there is a dividing line. I will continue to look and see if we can find solutions.
Exactly. We have 3 acres over here.
This whole area, this whole
building. That's what I was going to talk to the city administration and kind of look it around and see what we can find to, and kind of have those conversations.
So when you're looking at what you're looking at on mapping, has the school district updated their boundary line maps?
No.
No, it's a huge political process where you would be
constitutional amendment. Yeah,
you'd be asking White River to give up a lot of the commercial along 410, which they're
gonna do. No.
Yeah, if you're reading the map right.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, because it comes way into that one housing development that has that agreement to swap.
Yeah, it's like where the Costco is, Midtown Park, Fred Meyer, all of that landed in White River.
Exactly. Yeah, and the back of Cedar View for some odd reason.
Yeah, and the back of Cedar View, it's really weird shape.
It is really weird
over there.
It's very non-cool.
It literally splits my neighborhood down the middle between the two school districts, and my neighborhood has 16 houses.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
That's weird. It's crazy.
It's really weird.
I apologize for getting everybody's hopes up.
Here's the deal.
Doesn't matter. That confirmation.
Pretty good. Lakes boundaries.
Yeah.
Kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So next week, not next month, but not next week, next month. So if we can have any sort of idea that I can begin to take forward for property, I think having the school district build the pool on the hill as opposed in the valley is good.
Mm-hmm.
Water, for me, my passion is water's a killer. It's a vicious killer, and we can't teach enough people to swim.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Very good. It just, Councilmember McClymans, you know, thank you for bringing it up because it goes to demonstrate the importance of working together for solutions like Deputy Mayor Carter was working on all those different parties, right? Because just because there may be a boundary issue there, it doesn't mean it won't happen or will happen, but, you know, there's creative solutions that we can all work together and find ways to make things happen, right? That's an excellent example. It's just fantastic to have the pool up here somewhere. It'd be great. Right?
The city has other city-owned properties that I guess you guys can look at and see what could be possibility.
How big is the Reed property?
We do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right hold down to the floor right here.
Up here. Right over here.
Not letting anybody walk on it.
Yeah, you keep swim on it.
On this side.
Awesome, thank you.
No problem.
Thank you. Any other open discussion?
Councilmember Baldwin.
Thank you.
Yeah, I feel like, first of all, agenda item E is going to be quite an extensive conversation. Just a thought there. We're not even there yet. Question about the Historical Society and where, is there any discussions on where they could move? I know that it sounds like they may be getting kicked out. And so is there other options where they can go or we can house them?
Yes, so what we've been talking to them about is the Public Works modular.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if all of you have been up to the Public Works site,
mm-hmm.
but in the back 40 of the property, if you will, we have a double-wide modular that was used for a staff lunchroom and a couple staff meeting rooms. Leslie Harris, the assistant mm-hmm. to the city administrator, has taken the lead on working with the Historical Society on coming up with a lease for that property. And then I believe it was a week ago Friday, the mayor, Joanne from the Historical Society, one or two of our Public Works folks, and Leslie actually toured the building.
Okay, so I think maybe I misunderstood, but maybe not. I thought that they were in their current location without paying anything at all, or are they?
Well, they compensate us.
I do not believe there was ever a formal written agreement.
Okay, yeah, because I feel like that was part of their concern.
You know, public access thing, whatever it is, public benefit thing that we do with them. I don't know if that's a formalized kind of thing, right?
Because we had proposed a lease that also included a half-time employee to be a community center type person. visitor centers type person in pre-COVID. And I know that failed, and I don't believe we actually have a formal lease agreement with them.
A little minor thing. Because like we do with the Lions for kids or something, you know, in my mind, hopefully you can find a location for the folks. Then I don't.
We do have an agreement for the Lions with kids.
Yeah. Because I'd heard from the historical folks that they were concerned that the new agreement was kind of like extensive or something at one point. But I don't know. You know, more issues for staff to work out, right? I think unless somebody's going to say that they, because the bottom line to me is that the Historical Society is in a location that's kind of substandard right now, and they need a more permanent-ish, you know, newer home, right? Because that building that they're in is going to be a maintenance nightmare at any point in time. It really needs to be dealt with quickly as we can. Otherwise, somebody's going to be in here saying the roof just fell in and you need to go fix it for X number, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And we do have funds in the current biennium to demolish the old City Hall. But certainly we would find a place for the Historical Society before we demolish City Hall.
My opinion.
Council Member Baldwin still has a question.
My last question is, I was just kind of curious as to what is the process for hiring a replacement for Ryan Johnstone?
The mayor has appointed Jason Sullivan as the interim.
I knew that.
Yeah, under the code, that can be for up to a year.
Okay. And so, like, there's no I guess what you're telling me is there's no process. Like, there's not an active process to look for.
There's not an active recruitment process currently.
Oh, okay. So you're in the position right now, either for a year, I'm assuming. Is there going to be somebody then that is in Jason's position, and what would be the recruitment for that, or is he absorbing both positions?
Yeah, Jason's positions as development services manager would remain vacant while he serves in the interim capacity.
Okay, and then is there, I guess, active recruitment for that position?
No, not right now.
Okay. Is there a plan for that at any point?
Well, we would do an active recruitment for the public services director position. If Jason were not the successful candidate, he would go back to the development services manager position, and the new person would assume the position as director of the department.
Okay.
We have not started that yet.
Okay.
You know when you will? Or you plan to start that?
Well, the plan is to, do it later this fall.
So right now Planning Commission has been Jason's thing. Is that mean I saw that, like, Planning Commission meeting coming up has been canceled. Is that being canceled because we don't have somebody sitting in that seat? Or, Jason, are you still doing that?
No, it didn't get canceled because of the staffing issues. It was because, our dream of moving our Planning Commission meetings out there to the Public Services Building, we finally got them to come in and install a camera, and we didn't get it go to the 5th of February, and we felt like if something would go wrong, it would go wrong because we were trying to have a meeting on Wednesday night. So I worked with Grant, and we just moved it to the 21st so that we could finish the installation of the technology that would allow us to move out of the council chambers finally and into that meeting. So that was the real driver behind behind that process.
So you're still double dutying it then?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry.
Nope. I know. I told him not to.
And Council Member Roach had a question.
I have a couple of things I want to discuss. The PCRC meeting that Jason talked about happened a couple of weeks ago, so I want to give you an update on that. And then actually I met with Jason at the Public Works, and then he gave me a little tour afterwards, which really nice, very nice. One thing I was thinking, because we had just had that presentation on the risk management, was we have, I thought it was, I don't know, several, but like 17 generators, backup generators for all the lift stations, and they can hold fuel for about 3 days. My thought was if we had something major where the electricity went out, mm-hmm. we wouldn't be able to fuel any of those. So my question was, have we looked into I guess you could put it underground or above ground, just big tank where we can fuel our vehicles on site. And anyway, Jason was going to look into that for me. Maybe that's something we can talk about later on, but just want to let you know I inquired about it. And, hopefully it could be a cost saving too, because right now we're just going to like random gas stations. So
yeah, the long term plan has always been to hopefully get two above ground fuel tanks out of what we call the decant site. That's that Chris Lear piece that we're talking about off of 96. Two 20,000, one for regular gasoline and one for diesel, so that we would have that kind of redundant capacity. If it's something the council is interested in exploring, we could always bring it forward as a decision card for the budget this year. It's more of a costing issue and adding it to the CIP projects list and where that ranks in projects. But Council Member Roach is correct. We have 26 lift stations all running generators, and I talked with Todd. They all are diesel backup generators.
Except for the 911 sites. Those are propane.
Yeah, the 911 sites. I was just talking the lift station ones.
All right, and so back to the Pierce County Regional Council. So I attended that with Jason via Zoom. It was kind of, my thoughts is that I don't know if they've been out of practice for a while, but it was pretty unorganized. Like, I don't know if the staff was new or what was going on. But having said that, there was a lot of confusion. There were four amendments. Ours was amendment number 17, and Jason talked about it a couple weeks ago. We're basically, so our urban growth area has explained as the city of Bonnie Lake, if we're going to make any changes to that, you've got to delete part of it and then add. So in 17, it was taking out a little chunk. It's way up by Lakeland Hill, so it's way out there, something we'll never as a city ever, you know, connect with sewer and everything. So that was what we were taking out to add along 410, isn't it?
Along 96, along between 96. The city limits and 96.
Yeah, so that's what Amendment 17 did. This was, you know, originated on the county side, so everybody seemed to be okay with that. Someone came, or a lot of people were confused, like I said, so they wanted to just move it and just say, let's wait on all four amendments and come back next month or whatever. And I did move to table the other three, but to pass Amendment 17. Amendment 17 did pass. I thought it was unanimous, but then again, the confusion. Dave Morrell was trying to get recognized, and they never did. But he voted no on it. He's our council member over our area, so I talked to him the next day to you know, have the conversation. So he was concerned, obviously, because he's been contacted by this the small spot up there by Lakeland Hills, and they don't want to lose, you know, be taken out of the UGA. So I had the conversation with Dave and his planner, and we had a good conversation. He understands the, you know, what's going on, but it's still kind of difficult for him because he does have constituents that are, you know, wanting them to just kill the whole thing. Having said that, I think, you know, we're probably in a pretty good position on the council level, but that's where it goes back to. It'll go back to the county council, and they'll be the ones that vote on it. So assuming it goes through that, then our Amendment 17 would be done. So there is a little bit of ways to go, and there is a little concern there. So just wanted to bring you up to speed on it.
So that UGA that's up there, is you're trading somebody, apparently.
It was a conversation about affiliated and unaffiliated potential annexation areas. So there was a bill passed in the legislature to allow for UGA swaps. That was an unaffiliated UGA that no one wanted, and so we worked there with the county to make that part of the swap because we have property owners along 96 that have been wanting to come into the urban growth area so that we could eventually annex them. So very political.
Makes sense. Yeah, yeah. There's always those little, like, the hard.
It's a very delicate dance between everybody.
Yeah. Because losing UGA status for some people is always a concern, right?
Right.
Yeah,
and there, it's really, I mean, they're closer to Auburn, but they're right next to Auburn. They're way far away from the city of Bonnie Lake, and they're just an island that I don't think anyone will ever connect to. So it's a tough.
Yeah, and, you know, and FYI for council, and I don't know why I say this, but that I'd call it the DeLeo Amendment. That's long before because, you know, that's so screwy out 96th Street there, that little sawtooth action. Is congratulations to some previous council members that sat here 20 years ago and said, oh, okay, well, we'll just leave that off. you know, and just had no foresight to the future and straightening things out. So that's why our boundaries are so screwed up, is because of poor decision making when they originally laid out the UGA. They specifically did it too, you know. They really, our boundaries looked nice when they originally laid them out until they came to the city council, and then the city council at that time hosed it up.
Thank you, Dan. For
yep. You want to add anything, Jason? Anything I left out?
No, I think the council, the county is trying to find ways to work with the city. The county recognizes that the amendment is a good idea. It's been supported by staff. I think even Councilman Morrell actually supported the amendment initially, but it's this
horse trading.
Well, horse trading, and there's this feeling of winners and losers, and trying to balance that out. And so, we met with Mike Krueger, who's one of the policy analysts, and talked about options, and hopefully trying to find a win-win for everybody. But I don't know if we can get there. But we definitely talked about ideals and approaches to be able to try to help soften those types of things.
Okay.
I got one thing, sorry.
Any further comments?
Yeah, Councilmember Fullerton. I just have a quick announcement. I was at the CFF meeting on last Thursday, and we are actually having a community resource fair here in City Hall or Justice Center here on February 17th from 12 noon to 3 p.m. So that's going to help people with housing, mental health, healthcare, medical coverage, and counseling, youth and adults, transportation, education, autism support, dementia, Alzheimer's support. So you all probably have a flyer that was placed in your box, and that will be Carla Lewis is our manager for that. So that's all I have.
What is CFF?
It is Communities for Families. So it's the school district, and anybody's welcome to attend. It's the first Thursday at 3 o'clock to 4:30, and you can go Zoom, or it's at the school district office, and it's all school district people. They discuss resources on how to help their homeless families, how to, you know, they work with the food bank, they work with our community court, they have a bunch of different organizations like the YMCA and the public libraries that show up, and they just try to collaborate and network and try to figure out how to help the community.
You said that's first Thursday, 3:30?
First Thursday at 3 to 4:30.
3 to 4:30.
Yeah. And that's at and Mary Lee Hill, Anderson. She usually, I asked her to reach out to the new members if they wanted to join, but I don't know if you got those yet. So
you can always drop in too.
Yeah.
Yeah. As long as there's not like 12 of us show up.
Yeah. As long as we try to keep it. If there's going to be four of us, then we need to let City know. Let Sadie. But usually there was just Tom and I that showed up. So
awesome. Thank you for that.
Yeah. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else? I can't see anybody, so.
No one else.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay. We will move on to a review of council minutes. Councilmember Fullerton?
I did not see any changes.
Nice. Okay. I did not either. Thank you. Moving on to our actual discussion, item E is public comments. Obviously, this was in the packet. Everybody read that, hopefully, about all the hate speech stuff that's been going on recently. And so I guess I talked to the attorney, Ms. Robertson. Maybe she can fill us in a little bit more and provide some info for this discussion.
Sure, happy to do that, Deputy Mayor. So a lot of cities, particularly as they've gone to virtual public comment, have had issues on with public comments being not necessarily on topic and a lot of hate speech.
At the start of COVID, when people started using Zoom, many cities experienced what is being called porn bombing, where people would turn on their cameras and microphones and do lewd acts on camera. A lot of cities, as a result, changed their online platform to, if they're using Zoom, to do Zoom webinars, which is where anyone can watch. But if they want to talk or be seen, they have to be put through as a panelist. I know some cities that do that. They don't typically allow cameras on. If someone is wanting to speak, they put them through temporarily as a panelist, and then when their time is up, they push them back out into the audience section. So there is technology that can do that. Most cities, but not all, don't allow mics and cameras on because of the issues they've had. I know of one Pierce County city that does allow mics on, and they have everything from, you know, young prepubescent boys yelling fart or something similar during a council meeting to people making anti-Semitic comments, using fake names, and saying really, really hateful things. So a lot of cities are dealing with this. There's also in-person public commenters. In King County, there is a frequent commenter that comes to many people, converts his comments with a Nazi salute, and says very, very hateful things, using lots of foul language and slurs against council members and other people, including racial and ethnic slurs. So that's been happening. It's increasing both in person and online, but the online tends to be more because people can hide behind a fake name. So a lot of cities are dealing with it in different ways, if that's something Bonnie Lake wants to deal with. I'm happy to talk about that. Some cities have limited public comments to a certain period of time. Many cities and county have limited comments to things on the agenda. Some have provisions where if they have only, for example, 30 minutes allowed, they allow the prioritization. If they have too many people signed up to speak, they allow to prioritize people speaking on the agenda or things that are going to be on the agenda soon. They allow prioritization of people that haven't spoken in the last 90 days. There's all sorts of ways that you can legally do it in terms of managing the meeting. Some cities are not allowing online comments. Others are only allowing online comments when people sign up ahead of time. That's what the article that was at everyone's desktop talked about is one of the cities stopped allowing online comments and then talked about allowing only online comments if people sign up by 4 o'clock. It avoids the anonymous hate speech from happening. That said, if the council does have someone providing hate speech, there's really nothing you can do unless it causes, if it's not against your council rules, if you don't have rules limiting it to the agenda, there's really nothing you can do if they are not causing an actual disruption of the meeting. So except for maybe make a comment after they are finished that that last speaker doesn't reflect Bonnie Lake's values and we disagree with what they said. I mean, but otherwise, if we are providing a forum where people can come and talk about anything for a given amount of time, people can come and talk about anything for a given amount of time if it doesn't cause an actual meeting disruption. So I'm happy to answer questions or engage in dialogue with council about this, but I know that Deputy Mayor Carter asked me about this earlier. I've had conversations with several of you about this topic offline, and so happy to help. Thank you, Deputy Mayor.
Thank you. Any comments or questions for council?
Councilmember Baldwin?
I'm sure you guys can guess how I feel about this. I read both of the articles, and yes, they are disturbing and things like that, but to me it just feels very calculated. A ploy of some sort just to cause there to be more restrictions to citizens. I don't want to create more barriers. I already think it's hard. Again, to speak to a legislative body and some of even the things that are lawfully able to be done. I just think of when I've, you know, tried to speak and talk in legislative sessions, you know, where they have people coming in and they have limitations. You have to have signed. I have to read a long thing just to figure out, like, how can I even contact you? How can I even say something? And they do things like, you know, waiting the however many days, or, well, we're going to prioritize this. Well, I'm like the 80th person, and then the time limit is up, and then you can't even talk to your legislative body. And so I think that's very frustrating. I think just because a couple of people are being, you know, interesting online, I do agree that I read through the things, and they are disturbing, but I still remember a memory when I was like 13 years old, and my mom, who is Korean, born and raised in Japan, and, you know, she had seen this article and was talking to me about it, about a KKK rally potential in Auburn, you know, where they were wanting to do that there. This was back in the 90s. And I was infuriated and thought, like, oh, we can't allow them to do that. We can't allow them to, you know, say anything because they're a hate group, obviously, and all these kinds of things. And my mom really taught me something at that time in saying, you know, if we silence them, then there's an ability to silence other types of groups of people, you know. And so I think we have to proceed with caution in how we're going to limit people's ability to talk to us. Because we do have people saying certain things sometimes, and maybe it feels a little offensive, but it is what it is. I mean, they get to do that. So I don't know. I don't know what your thoughts are, but those are my thoughts. I wouldn't agree with any kind of restrictions.
Yeah. Councilmember Roach?
Going back now, it's been a while, but I'm trying to think of the Pierce County Council. They, in their rules, I believe it is when they do that session, it is anything that is not on the agenda that hasn't been discussed, but that is county business. I have to go back and look, but so there are guidelines on, you can't just go up and say whatever you want. It's based on the, whether it's city business or county business. I mean, I always, when I chaired, I gave people a lot of latitude, but there were times when things were just completely, had nothing to do with the topic and was totally out of line, and I would just gavel them down. And that's pretty par for the course, I think, for most cities or counties. In a legislative, if you're a legislator, you have rules as well. So you can't just stand up on the House floor and say whatever you want. You've got to be within that bill that is being discussed, and if it's not, you know, the Speaker Pro Tem will gavel you down as well. So there are, you can set limits and do that and not, you know, shut down free speech, I think. So you've got to be able to continue with your meeting. So there's got to be a happy medium there. But I think there's enough examples, cities, counties, what our state does, where we could take a look too and see what they're doing to see if it's what we're doing. And see what we can couple with.
Thanks. Yeah, I
do. But
I agree. I don't think anybody wants to shut down free speech. I think we want to have the opportunity for people to come here and tell us whatever they want. This is the free area. Obviously, we don't want that, the hate speech and whatnot. There's things that should be stopped. We have to be very careful if we're going to do that. I completely agree with Councilmember Baldwin. Back in the 90s, I was working for Enumclaw PD, and they actually had a Nazi rally in Enumclaw, and we ended up having to protect the people doing the rally from everybody else, and that was a very weird spot to be in. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's free speech. I think the easy thing right now, and maybe we just do one thing or nothing, but I think it would be easy to just say, you have to sign up ahead of time if you're going to speak virtually. That seems to stop a lot of it, and it doesn't stop free speech. It maybe does put up a little bit of a barrier, but I think it's more of a speed bump. But I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there to see what you guys think.
Councilmember Baldwin?
Yeah, so with the county or city business, for example, I think the problem that I have with that is, you know, when you even restrict it to it being like, oh, it needs to be city or county business, or it has to be something that's on the agenda, The way that you limit people then is like when things were going on with COVID, there was a lot of larger things that people wanted to say to us that were outside of even the city business. And a lot of people felt like there was a lot of things that were going on and that they wanted legislative bodies to do, but they were unheard because it wasn't on the agenda or it wasn't specifically some sort of a city and county business. And I feel like that's like you're treading on a line where you can easily say like, oh, that's not city business. So no, you don't get to say that. I mean, we have a constituent that normally tells us about things that is not necessarily city business, but it is his right to come and tell us all of the things he thinks is wrong with America, you know, and I think that's okay. I think he should have a place to be able to say that. I agree that legislative bodies do have rules, yes, but constituents are different. They're different. They are the people, right? And so they should be able to access us in a different way. I think the problem I have with the signing up ahead of time, and I've experienced this myself as a person on the other side, is something will come up, mm-hmm. and I've even done that in legislative session, something will come up that I want to then address, and then I can't because I didn't sign up ahead of time. And I don't like that. I don't like that limitation on people. But those are my two cents.
I have to agree. And then Council Member Swatman had something to say.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, I understand what you guys are saying, but my experience shows me that I'm more, you know, and Mr. Roach has a lot of experience in different legislative bodies, so he's kind of probably has more examples. But, you know, my understanding is that the council provides a limited public forum, right? So if we're going to confuse it with an outside rally, which is a different format, clearly, you know, this is a limited public forum, so there has to be some decorum that goes along with it. So if you can ever get to, you know, I'd be very supportive of anybody with any type of tools that are, you know, don't limit as possible, but I'm going to be, like, horrified when the day comes that somebody's going to come here and say some hate speech stuff, you know, especially, you know, they can attack me all day long. My cell phone number's on the website, you know, call me up, yeah, anytime you want. When they start attacking staff, you know, what are you going to do as a council member? You know, we're clearly here to protect and, you know, make sure that the city functions properly. So how's that going to be great when, you know, a constituent comes forward and just berates the heck out of a staff member? Is that going to be like, okay, I guess kind of, because they kind of do that really. But, you know, there's that edge in there of trying to figure out what's, and I don't know how that works out. But so, you know, bottom line is, if it helps to defend a little bit to have them sign up, maybe, but, you know, plus or minus, I don't mind. You know, it'll be just horrific in my mind when it happens, when we have an audience full of people and somebody comes up here and wants to be just totally off. You know, it's just going to be like, wow, I really don't need this forum to have people yell stupid comments.
Well, if that comes up, then we can always change the rules.
We can afterwards. But then that's fine. I don't think it's that, you know, it's like.
Councilmember Baldwin?
I think we, as far as like online is concerned, you know, we already have limitations in place mm-hmm. Where, you know, they have to turn off their microphone, right? And they have to turn off their camera. So, you know, I feel like that's already in place. And I feel like that's been working fairly well. I mean, it has stopped distracting, you know, kitchen situations, you know, and cooking and walking around and, you know, all those kinds of things. So I think that is helpful. So if somebody decided they wanted to do, you know, something lewd, you know, on screen, we are all adults. And so I think if somebody were to come in and say things, you know,
we are, but they're broadcast, right?
They are. It is, yes. Okay, so point.
So they get to continue for that 5 minutes? I'm sorry to interrupt.
I mean, they get 5 minutes. I don't know. Obviously, I'm not excited about those kinds of things. I don't think like, oh, somebody should come in here and like say all of them, whatever they want. But then, you know, where's the line?
Maybe the line can be if they do something lewd. You know, then we can
we'd have to define that
clearly.
What's
the definition of that, right?
Okay.
What's the definition?
You got to figure
out that stuff. Definitions are really important because, well, yeah, you can. skew.
And as we well know, most of those definitions include exceptions for art and anthropology.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Council Member McClimates, and I have to go because I have to go to work. Just so you take over the hand raising. Council Member McClimates.
Yeah, I think the county and the state legislative bodies are different. I think they're larger. I think they draw on a larger community, maybe more diverse. I think this is the smallest venue for people to come and speak. I've already experienced a significant amount of hate speech, and it doesn't just come at council meetings. It comes in emails, right? And social media. I couldn't support any sort of restriction until it got. I could if we had a serious problem, right? I mean, if we really had some activists that were abusing people, I think we could take action at that point, but I don't see us preemptively taking action. We've had one semi-blatant incident in the last year. Before that, a couple years beforehand, we had a couple people come in and, you know, label people inappropriately. You know, oh well.
These just look like setups to me. They look like people like looking for forums to abuse.
Sure.
Like it's premeditated.
Right.
Or, you know,
right.
They start off talking about a road and then they careen into some.
Sure. As a city, I don't know. Do we, Bonnie Lake, have a problem?
Not yet.
Okay.
But I know.
And there's always calculating, people.
One thing I would just throw out there, though, if you can see it happening around you in other places, then it's something we should probably be thinking about. Just like Councilmember Swatman was talking about earlier, you know, council for 20 years ago, you know, did not think forward on UGA stuff and changed everything, and now we're kind of stuck with that. So this is an effort by staff, kind of like, hey, look, this is going on, to let us know. That's something that we should at least have this discussion about and see if there's anything that we want to do. I'm not necessarily saying we have to. I'm just, you know, it's worth talking about and thinking about. And there may be something small that we could do that would prevent it from ever happening. I don't know. I think I saw Councilmember McClimates.
And those three over there, they did.
Yep. Councilmember Roach and Baldwin both.
Yep. I just had a question. Do we have a policy right now?
No. Not that I'm aware of.
Can we change the 5 minutes or anything, or
your policy?
Okay.
Absolutely.
And okay. So nothing written though.
Councilmember Roach, the other practice that the council has adopted is, which is relatively new, is having the video and the microphones off on the members of the public, but then during public comment, they all have self-control. So fortunately, you haven't had anybody turn the camera on and do anything or say anything when it wasn't their turn, but as it is operating right now, they could.
Please, go ahead.
You go ahead.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I would be comfortable with working on language that if an incident does occur that we can instantiate immediately via councilmatic action, so that if there would a single individual is behaving poorly, it would be unfortunate. But it would also prevent a chain of people coming in an activist, sort of an organized activist way, becoming abusive. So I think I could be ready to pull the trigger and trained to pull the trigger, but I don't want to pull the trigger.
So you wouldn't be able to be quite that nimble if the council, if you have rules, you can always be nimble and waive them. But if you don't have rules, you can't be nimble and because you don't like what one speaker did, change them that night. So you certainly can change your rules at any time to limit things to being on the agenda or to doing that for some meetings, but not all, to cutting down
time to requiring crew register, all those different tools that I mentioned. If you don't have them and you have something happen that night, it's going to probably take a little bit before we can bring rules back for adoption by the council.
Okay.
So, I mean, and that's fine. That's council's prerogative. But I just wanted to not give you a false expectation that we could, you know, something terrible happens and we adopt the rules that minute. So it just, it takes some time. But like I said, if you had something that didn't allow people to speak except on agenda items and someone came down and really wanted to fill you in on something, council could waive the rule for that night. You wouldn't want to make it a practice, though, because then you have the situation where you're picking and choosing who gets to break it. But once in a while, to waive the rules for good cause, that's something that council has the would have the authority to do anytime you have the council rule.
I think my speaking on just that part, still grasping and, you know, pulling all this in my brain, but just on that kind of that part of that limiting would limit somebody like the library lady that comes in and gives the random update if it's not on the agenda, or if the food bank was to say, hey, I want to come in today and I want to give you guys a quick little 5-minute update. So it would limit them unless we wanted to allow that if we had a, you know, it has to be on the agenda items.
Yeah, you could also
still do it for people who are in person. It would just, if you're going to speak virtually, then, you know, you have them sign up.
You could also have an agenda section that would be added. It's like reports from partner organizations. And then if someone shows up, you just slot them in there. There's different ways to go about it.
Okay, I'll just speak. I think the issue here, though, is hate speech, which, again, definitions matter, because a lot of people are offended by lots of things, and they say this is hate speech, that's hate speech, you know, and it's getting a bit on the ridiculous side. And so I think if we were to propose something that I could get behind, you know, maybe it would be defining very specifically what sort of lewd acts, for example, what sort of lewdness would not be appropriate on camera. And that might be uncomfortable to write down. But, you know, if we were to say specifically, these are the things that, you know, we won't be okay with, whether you're standing right here or you're on camera. And then the other being like defining what exactly hate speech is, because, again, definitions completely matter. And so if it is not clear enough, lots of things could be labeled as, you know, that's hate speech, even though, well, that's their prerogative to be able to say that. So that is something I could potentially get behind. But all these other limitations, I'm not a fan of.
Councilmember Baldwin, we can't really ban hate speech.
I know, but you guys are saying that you don't want people coming up here using profanity or saying anti-Semitic remarks or racial slurs, correct?
No, we're just talking about what – I'm not saying I want it or don't want it. I'm saying that's what's been happening, and if that is of a concern to the council, ways that you can control the public comment that might but is not guaranteed to reduce that, which would be requiring people to only speak on agenda items, requiring people to sign up ahead of time. You aren't going to necessarily, even with those rules, in my experience, stop people from making hateful remarks. You hopefully reduce it and reduce the risk. Because hate speech is, if they have the right to talk on any topic, they have the right to say what they want.
So you're saying that we can't put something in place that says a person can't come in here naked?
Nudity
or be naked
and lewd acts
camera
are different than hate speech. I just want
to... Okay, so... And then
I think we could ban lewd acts, potentially. I haven't looked at that specific issue.
I mean, I don't see why we could.
It could be a criminal act, potentially, especially if they're here naked, using it for.
Yeah.
And there's just being naked is not necessarily a crime unless there is a sexual motivation, right, Chief? But
isn't that public
policy? We're not going to get into that.
I feel like it is.
I'm talking about hate speech versus lewd act. So I just wanted to clarify on the hate speech.
Okay.
Okay. Well, it sounds like if they were to bring something forward that was very specific, very targeted, that people might get behind that. We'd have to see what it is. Is that reasonable?
I don't know.
Okay.
Just being honest.
We'll have to look at it first.
Yep, sure would.
Yep. Okay. I think I at least have an idea of something we could bring forward that would be, it would tread very lightly. Because I agree with everybody, like everybody needs to be able to say whatever they want to say and speak to government, and we're government. So, and I agree whether we like it or not, right? So I think we could potentially bring something forward, but we'll look at that. Did anybody else have any comments or anything in regards to that at this point?
If you're looking at it, I mean, obviously, there's hundreds of different variations, again, from other cities and everything. So, I don't know, maybe make a compilation of, you know, best practices, or there's got to be best practices out there, or, you know, Robert's Rules or something to where, I mean, these meetings happen, thousands of them every week.
I can provide something for you. And it might be a good retreat topic. I don't know how packed that agenda is. But I don't really have any idea what to bring back to you if I was going to bring you back some council rules, but I can certainly bring you back some information about what other cities are doing and what you're legally allowed to do. Why don't I do that?
I think just do that.
I would love that.
Bring a few of them, let us take a look at them and see if there's anything we can find consensus on.
All right, we'll get that back to you in, I don't know, the next couple months. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you. Appreciate that. Any further comments? Okay, thank you, everyone. With that, we are adjourned.
Yay.
So much.
Not on there. Guys, we made it.
Oops. I think that little piece of GTA at the north end happens to be owned by a certain person that starts with C and ends with S.
Does it?
I don't know.
Later.
See you next time.
Bye, guys.